It is our pleasure now that we call upon our brother Chase.
Morning, brothers and sisters, young people. We're moving into a new season, back into routine. And our readings this morning put a very simple question in front of us, one I'd like to carry all the way to the memorial table. What's in your hand? Not what you wish was in your hand, not what you'd bring if you had more time, more knowledge, more capacity. What's actually in your hand this morning? Let's start in 2 Kings chapter 4. Because here, a widow comes to Elisha. Her husband has died, she's in debt, and a creditor is coming to take away her two sons as servants to settle that debt. This is not a woman with options. Elisha asks her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what have you in the house?" And she answers, "Your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." Listen to that word, except. "I have nothing except this." She almost doesn't mention it. In her own accounting, that jar isn't an asset, it's a rounding error. It's a tiny thing left in an otherwise empty house. It's not worth putting on the list. And that jar is where God starts. Elisha tells her, "Go to your neighbors, borrow empty vessels, as many as you can. Shut the door behind you and start pouring." And she pours, and it keeps coming and it keeps coming. And it only stops when there's nothing left to fill. And then Elisha tells her, "Sell the oil, pay your debt, and live on what's left." And the thing that she dismissed as nothing becomes the launching point of God's provision. Now that chapter does it more than once. A little further on, the Shunammite woman has a spare room. Not a big deal. Just a room with a bed, a table, a stool, and a lamp. That's all. Yet later it becomes a place where the prophet of God stays and the room that a dead son is raised in. At the end of the chapter, a man comes with 20 barley loaves in front of 100 hungry men. And Elisha says, "Set it before them," and they eat and have some left over. A tiny jar, a modest room, and a few loaves of bread. Three times in one chapter, someone brings something that just doesn't look like enough. I think most of us are far more fluent in what we lack than in what we have. "I don't have time. I don't know enough scripture. Someone else could do it better. Someone else has stronger faith." But Elisha never asked the widow what she wishes she had. He asked what's already in the house. And that's the question that this chapter keeps putting to people. Not what's missing, what's here. There's a moment in Exodus 4 that asks the same thing more directly. Because in Exodus 4, Moses is standing in front of the burning bush, being sent by God to stand before Pharaoh. And he does exactly what we would do. He inventories what he doesn't have. "Oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent. I'm slow of speech and of tongue. I'm not the right person. I don't have what this requires." And God's answer earlier in that same chapter is a question. "Moses, what's that in your hand?" Moses' response was, "A staff, a shepherd's stick, 40 years of keeping someone else's sheep in the back of a desert." That's what he had. Moses focused on his mouth and saw what he was lacking, but God points to his hand and asks what was there. "You've already been doing this, Moses. Now lead my flock." Brothers and sisters, that's a change in direction that we could all use. Not what am I short of, but what has God already put in my hand? Maybe, just maybe, the thing that looks like a modest offering has been building in you precisely the characteristics that God needs for a larger calling. Now, there's a pressure that can creep in here, of course, and I want to deal with that before we go further. Because when we start talking about bringing what we have, it can quickly start to feel like we need to ask the question, did I bring enough? Did it work out? Did anything come from what I did? And Paul settles this in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. He says, "I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants or he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. Paul planted, Apollos watered, neither of them could make the seed open. That belonged to God." So the widow pours, but she didn't multiply the oil. Moses lifts the staff, but he didn't part the sea. We plant, we water, God gives the growth. Which means the outcome was never our department. Which isn't a lowering of the standard. It's a lifting of the weight. God gives the oil. So give God the oil. Give God the room. Give him the loaves. Give him the staff. Give him whatever is already in your hand. And let him do what he does. Now let's go back to Jeremiah chapter 52. And thank you to Noel for reading that for us. Because Jeremiah chapter 52 is a much harder chapter to sit in. Because 2 Kings 4 is full of oil that doesn't run out and sons who come back to life. But Jeremiah 52 is the opposite. Jerusalem falls. The walls are broken down. The temples burn. The pillars are broken up and they're carried off piece by piece. And the record slows right down to list it in painful detail. The bronze, the basin, the pots, all of it inventoried as it leaves. And the people are marched along behind it to Babylon. Everything that looked permanent is gone. And I think we have to be honest because there's an assumption that sits quietly in most of us until a chapter like this exposes it. Somewhere underneath, we can begin to believe that trusting God means that our lives won't come apart. But God never promises us that. So Jeremiah 52 asks a question that 2 Kings 4 doesn't have to ask. Can I still trust God when I can't see a single thing he's doing? You plant, you water, but nothing comes up. Not that year and not the next. Some of us are living in a version of that this morning, maybe. Something hasn't worked out. There's a grief that hasn't lifted, a relationship that changed and won't change back. Or we're just tired and the future looks nothing like what we'd hoped or pictured. But watch how Jeremiah ends his book. After all of that, after the burning and the breaking and the carrying away, verse 31 tells us that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, graciously freed Jehoiachin, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison 37 years in captivity, and the prison doors open. The king speaks kindly, and the prison garments are changed, and he's given a seat at the king's table, and he's provided for every day for the rest of his life. The last thing that the prophet Jeremiah shows us is a man at a table being fed. Yes, by the king of Babylon, but it's God giving the growth here, isn't it? Because this fallen king still had a part to play that he had not yet completed. Think about the captives who'd just been brought up out of Babylon after watching everything fall apart. Jerusalem's gone, the temple's gone, the throne of David, gone. If God had made promises to David about a son and a kingdom and a throne established from ever, from where they're sitting, those promises were ash. Consider the man himself. 2 Kings 24 tells us that Jehoiachin was carried from Jerusalem to Babylon along with his mother, his wives, his servants, the officials of the land. He was only 18 when he became king, and he was deported a very short time after. A king with no throne, no city, no country, a boy taken into captivity with his house and his nation. But notice who wasn't in that list. No sons, no heirs are listed. This is the line of David. No sons and no heirs are listed when he's taken to Babylon. But 1 Chronicles 3 records something quite remarkable. It lists Jehoiachin's sons, and it calls him Jeconiah the captive. The line of David continued in a man whose title was a prisoner. That's where it carried on. Not on a throne, but in captivity, in the dark, where no one was watching for it, where the believers had given up. And hundreds of years later, Matthew opens his account with a line that runs from Abraham to Christ, and there he is, Jeconiah, the same man, through the fire, through the captivity, through 37 years in a Babylonian prison, the line held, and it arrived at Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God. So what looked like the end was not the end. God's purpose was moving the entire time, and not one person living through Jeremiah 52 could see it moving. We must not confuse a broken chapter in our life with the end of what God is doing. We don't have to see the whole account to trust the one who knows the end from the beginning. Our part hasn't changed. We plant, we water, God gives the growth, and he gives it in his own time, which may be long after we've stopped looking for it. So God's working then, even when there's nothing to see. That much Jeremiah settles. But let's go over to 1 Corinthians now. We'll go to chapter 12, the reading we didn't get to. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and 13. Because the question is no longer, is God doing anything? Jeremiah settled that. The question is now, where do I fit into what he's doing? And that's 1 Corinthians 12. Because here, brothers and sisters, Paul answers that question. He answers, where do we fit? We fit as members in a body. Verse 12 says, for just as the body is one and has many members. And then down in verse 18, which is the one I want us to hold. But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. God arranged them. Not the members, not by talent, not by production volume, not by who put their hand up. He chose. He placed. Which means the foot is not a failed hand. The ear was never supposed to be an eye. And then verse 22, which ought to stop us. On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. Not tolerated, not made room for, cannot be done without. But now hear how we talk about ourselves. I'm only a young person. I'm only a senior. I'm only a parent. I only help behind the scenes. I only make meals. I can only send someone a message. I only can offer a prayer for this person. We're remarkably quick to put the word only in front of the very thing that God calls indispensable. The widow had her own version of that word only. Hers was except. Nothing in my house. Oh, except a jar of oil. Moses had one too. I'm not eloquent. Different words, same move. Each one of them opened with what they weren't. David was just keeping sheep when he was sent for. Mary was a young woman in an unremarkable town. God has never seemed to need us to arrive impressive. So let me name the thing that does the quiet damage in a body like ours. It isn't that people have nothing to bring. It's comparison. It's looking sideways at what someone else carries and deciding that what we're holding doesn't count. And once we decided that, it's very easy to stop bringing it entirely. The body loses exactly the part that Paul says it can't do without. Your oil is not their oil. Your place is not their place. So bring it anyways, and bring it joyfully, because God is the one who put it in your hand to bring. And then Paul turns, because in 1 Corinthians 13, he's going to tell us that the gift isn't the point. What we're bringing isn't the point. He says, if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. So we need to feel the two ends of this. The widow says, I have nothing, but she gives her little to God and he makes it more than enough. Paul says, you can have everything, knowledge, ability, faith that moves mountains. Still be nothing. Very little placed in God's hands becomes much. Very much without love becomes nothing. So the question is not how much am I getting done, it's how much love is in the things that I'm doing. And Paul doesn't leave that vague. In verses 4 through 7, he gives about 15 short statements describing love. But just notice, run your eyes over it, verses 4 through 7, what kind of statements they are. They're not feelings. They're verbs. Paul never tells us what love feels like. He tells us what love does, and more often than not, what it doesn't do, what it refuses to do. 8 of those 15 are negatives. Love does not envy, does not boast, is not arrogant, is not rude, does not insist on its own way, is not irritable or resentful, does not rejoice at wrongdoing. Which means love, for Paul, is mostly measured in what we don't do to each other. So let me take two of those negatives, and I've picked the two that a body like ours might be the most likely to struggle with. One is how I react when another member is doing well, and another is how I treat people when I'm running low. The first, love does not envy. Can I, reflecting on it myself, can I be glad, actually glad, when someone else is doing well, the very thing that I wanted to do? That's the test that belongs right here. It's right out of chapter 12. Because if we can't rejoice in another member's gift, we haven't understood that we're all one body. We all benefit. And we've just been busy ranking each other, ranking ourselves against each other. The second, it's not irritable or resentful. And here's maybe where most of us live. Not in the dramatic things, in the tired things. How do I speak to people closest to me at the end of a long week when I've given what I have and I'm running low? That's usually where the love in my service is measured. Not in what I did, but in how I was while I did it. The body doesn't work simply because every member finds their gift. It works when every member uses their gift in love. Now, in a few moments, we're going to take the bread and wine. And here's what I'd ask you to notice as that bread and wine comes down your row. When the bread reaches you, your hand is going to be open, empty, receiving. I've spent this morning asking what's in your hand, but the answer at this table is going to be whatever is put in it. We didn't bring the bread. We didn't earn a seat here. Nothing we've poured out this year purchased what's being placed in our hands this morning. God gave first. He gave his son, and his son gave himself. He gave his time to people who could give him nothing back. He gave his strength until he had none left. He gave compassion to the sick and the rejected and the forgotten. He submitted his own will to his father's in a garden at night when everything in him wanted another way. And then he gave his life. He was not a man deciding what he could spare. He held nothing back at all. And God raised him. So think again about that last picture in the book of Jeremiah. A son of David, brought out of prison, seated at a table, fed for the rest of his days by a kindness he had no claim on. That's us this morning. We're the ones brought out. We're the ones seated. We're the ones being fed. And the son of David at the center of it is not in a Babylonian court. He's at God's right hand. And he's coming back to reign. And this table is how we keep saying so until he does. This bread we break is his body given for us. The cup we share, that's the new covenant in his blood. So bring your jar of oil. Bring your spare room. Bring your 20 loaves, your shepherd's staff, your ordinary week, the small, unimpressive thing you were going to leave off the list. Bring it. But not to earn anything, but because your hand was filled first. God filled it then. God fills it now with his son. Let's remember him.